copyright forum of Christian leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
So what I'm suggesting is that the features that we have given to us in the creation account, roughly from Genesis 1 to Genesis 5. Now, I know that includes more than the creation account, but I suggest that that gives us hints about how it is that God has structured his, what I call creation order, within which his divine attributes operate within human history. That is, I'm going to argue it is this what I call creation order that provides the necessary and appropriate rules, and I use that word somewhat advisedly, for the kind of creation that God was going to call into existence. Now, there are a number of unspoken assumptions that are just kind of running in the background, but they're only going to be running in the background of my mind. So you're going to think, well, where'd he come? Why is he not saying this? Why is he not saying that? It's a rather condensed kind of a lecture. So if you have questions about assumptions that you think might have been going on here that you'd like to challenge, you're certainly welcome to ask them during our time. For those who are familiar, and many of you may not be, of the structure of a suzerainty covenant, as we find in the ancient Near Eastern text, creation order is something on that model. But maybe what is more familiar to you would be if I use the concept of rules for a game, or maybe a syllabus for a course in an academic university. That is, something that sets out what are the rules, what are the guidelines, how do we get on with this class, or how do we get on with this game? And that marks out how everybody has to behave. And I'll refer to that a little bit later on. And what I'm calling this is a creation order. I have a book that is simply titled Creation Order Theodicy. And it's how I would want us to think about the problem of evil within that creation order. So put rather succinctly, this creation order is what provides, what I think provides, the appropriate moral structure for the kind of creation that God is going to call into existence. And what is included in this moral structure was determined by the goodness of God, and it flows from his sovereign choices. And that is going to determine what are the limits, the nature, and the possibilities of man within that order. So whatever this moral order includes, it is always consistent with God's good character and shaped by his sovereign will. Now, let me say that when I speak of God's sovereignty in this case, I'm simply saying that when God decides to create, he is not informed by anybody outside, that whatever he creates, whatever he calls into existence, is done purely out of his own character. That's what I mean by God's will. So let me look then at Genesis. We'll look primarily at 1 through 2. But I will be making some comments and then try to bring it together. Now, what we learn is in Genesis chapter 1 that there is a physical order to the universe. And I don't think anybody is going to dispute that today. And it demonstrates to us the relationship of each part of creation to the whole. And then it ends up with a summary statement by God in which he says, everything that he had made was very good. And the Hebrew there is a very broad word. And it could mean aesthetically good, functionally good, without flaw. It probably means all of those things. At least I think it does. So we see the order of the physical universe, and I think what you'll find is that there is a mimicking, so to speak, of the moral order from the physical order. Whatever we might say then about this divine evaluation, it clearly informs us that creation, as it comes from God, I hold to an ex nihilo view, that it was without any moral flaw and was good only in the sense that a contingent entity can be good. So if we say a contingent energy, entity is good, we don't mean the same thing when we say a necessary being is good. But we understand what good means. But good applied, predicated of God, is different than good in a sense that it's not to the same robust way. Good is involved with this creation. So at least we can know that from what we get when this summary statement. Now, what we find in the early chapters is that man is given dominion over creation. And what this reveals very clearly is that there is a moral structure in the relationship between man and the rest of creation. That is, man has some moral responsibility to God for how he engages, takes care of, cares for nature. Today we call it creation care. Some would call it in the secular world ecology, but without any reference to man being responsible for this as a vice regent of God. Later, we learn, in Genesis 5, we learn about genealogies, and that tells us that there is a continuity to history, and that choices and acts of prior generations tend to expand or limit the choices of future generations. So what we learn about this created order, there is a causal relationship in it, but there's also this sense of continuity. So why do we have the genealogies? Why do we have to know who begat who begat who begat who? Well, because there's a continuity to human history, that human history has significance, that it is not just a piece of theater that is being played out after a script has been written. We also learn that there is a garden that is placed in the middle of this, what is called, and in the midst of this garden, we have this tree that's called the knowledge of good and evil, but also we have this garden that's just filled with all kinds of trees. We don't know particularly what particular fruits they produced, but they were there to be consumed, and we assume they were to be delighted in. So there's an ascetic aspect to creation order, that God didn't just create something that was functional, though it is very functional, but it's more than that. It has an aesthetic value to it as well. And then we learn that man gets to name the animals, and this reveals something of the correspondence between the mind of God and the mind of man. It's interesting that God names the heavenly bodies, but he allows man to name the animals. Now, I'll simply say, I think he names the animals according to their essence and not according to their function. And that's why he gets it right. But he can only do that if there's some kind of a correspondence between the mind of God and the mind of man. And that tells me then that Adam has a real mind. Doesn't have a make-believe mind. He is not just a receiver of information that then that has an output of data. He really has a mind that has a will, etc. This is all bound up in what I call the notion of the creation order. So we also learn that this particular tree in the midst of the garden that has a moral aspect attached to it, for we learn that Adam and Eve are commanded that of any tree in the garden they could eat freely, but of this tree in the midst of the garden, one of knowledge of good and evil, that they should not eat of it. For the day that they eat thereof, dying, the Bible says, they shall surely die. Once again, reveals this moral order that there is to the universe, that God has structured it this way, where there's a choices have moral consequences to them. Now, this is important for us to understand when we're looking at the problem of evil, because where does evil come from? And is there any such thing as gratuitous evil? Is there evil that takes place in this universe, at least on planet Earth? I can speak to that more directly than I can the universe. It's a much larger task for me. So I'll say the planet Earth. I would even affirm that there is such a thing as gratuitous evil. There's an evil that has no purpose in any cosmic sense. And that is because man is really given a choice. And choices will have consequences. So if you eat of the tree, man will really die. And if you don't eat, then you will not die. So we see how this this ability to choose, call it what you will, this ability to choose, man now becomes a causal agent. He is not just simply somebody that can make a choice that makes no difference, because that really wouldn't be a choice at all. So what we find then is this gives us some hints, I think, regarding the nature of this creation order. It reveals something of the ontological uniqueness of man, that man has some kind of what we call significant freedom. Sometimes we'll use the term free will, which I don't particularly care for. Sometimes we use the word libertarian freedom. I'm just going to say that man has some kind of significant freedom, and that he is not just does he have freedom, but it's a real kind of freedom where he can actually do A or he can refrain from doing A. So he doesn't just have the power of choice. He has the power to choose. And there is a difference between those two words. He can choose to refrain. He can choose to do whatever. Furthermore, he is pictured as a causal agent. That is, his choice can really bring death. There's a causal relationship between the act of the will and what's actually going to unfold in human history. But it is only this way, because this is the way that God has structured his creation order. And God is not going to wipe away, rip apart the choices that man makes by simply eliminating the consequences, even though they might be negative consequences. So this reveals, I think, how human choice can shape the direction of human history. But once again, it's only this way because that's how God has structured his creation order. For example, an umpire does not make a ball either foul or fair in the game of baseball. It's the foul line that determines that. You can only have a foul ball or a fair ball in baseball if there is such a thing as a foul line. But the foul line doesn't make the ball foul or fair. Okay? Furthermore, we see that there are broad boundaries for human choices, which guarantee the end of human history will be as God determined. Some would say, well, wait a minute. If God has this kind of freedom, that he is not just that he has the freedom to make choices, but he's actually a causal agent, doesn't that put at risk God's plan for his creation? And I would argue, no, that there are boundaries within which that power of choice can be exercised and not outside of that. And because there, in fact, we do actually have times when it appears that the choices of humanity are such that it almost looks like human history is going to move outside these boundaries and you have God intervening. For example, Genesis chapter 3, look at Genesis chapter 6, the flood. There are choices. Every imagination of his heart was only evil continually. Or you can look at Genesis chapter 11, where we have the Tower of Babel. It looks like things are going to get outside of the boundaries. God intervenes. And in that case, he just confuses the languages. But that's God's providential powers that work in conjunction and in sync with his creation order. And all of this, I think, then points to the fact that there are moral lines which give order to the universe, lines that God respects, if not, even if everything doesn't turn out well. We find in Genesis chapter 2, 17, the day thou eatest thereof, thine thou shalt surely die. They eat, they die. We have the children of Israel just before they go into the land of Canaan, Deuteronomy 29. God says, if you do this, I will bless you. If you do this, I will curse you. And then once they get into the land, they get on Mount Gerizim, Mount Ebal, and these six tribes on each mountain calling back the curses and the blessings, and they're all predicated upon what will Israel choose to do. And I think that these lines that God has given are in some fashion written on our heart, according to Romans chapter 2, and of course more explicitly they are stated and illustrated in the Bible. Now, when these lines, these moral lines across, like a ball in baseball crosses the line and it becomes a foul ball, when man makes bad choices, there are obviously negative consequences. And oftentimes that is what we seem to do. We seem to make choices that are on the foul side of the moral line. And because we are causal agents, that results in bad consequences. But God does not step in and eliminate the bad consequences, like with a giant cosmic erasure, and he just erases it and says, oh, that shouldn't have happened, that's bad. No, he respects the order that he has put into the universe. So even though we may make choices that are not the best, God respects them. This means that there seems to be evil in this world that is simply gratuitous, that it serves no plan, no purpose in God's plan, but it happens because man is at odds with the moral order of the universe. And because he has significant freedom, when he goes against the moral order, there are negative consequences. So, but if there were no consequences to choices, then of course choices would simply be meaningless. No foul lines in baseball, then there are no foul or fair balls in baseball. You have to have the lines. Of course, creation order is such that God can and does intervene providentially in some cases. He does it, it seems to me, to mitigate the consequences, the bad consequences, or to bring humanity back within the lines or the boundaries of his counsel to assure the end will be as he has determined. And yet he may do that because he's simply compassionate on us. Sometimes he does it because it's for his purposes. And then sometimes it can be even, I think, in response to the prayer of his people. So the point that I'm making is that if I'm right about Genesis 1 through 5, this tells us about creation order and then explains how God's sovereignty is honored while man's freedom is preserved and makes room for gratuitous evil without it in any way impinging on the moral goodness of God, because it is God's goodness that has created this moral order in which these things take place. God is in control by his providential interaction with humans, by answering prayer or just being gracious. And yet all that happened, or I shouldn't say all that happened, but human choices, and particularly the evil choices that man makes, simply means that God is not responsible for evil. He's only drawn the line. Man is held accountable for his choices because they are his choices, and he's a causal agent, and they have real consequences. That means then that God is not responsible for evil at all. And creation order manifests, I think, that the full manifestation, and I think this is the important point, is that the full manifestation of some of God's attributes are self-limitedly circumscribed by this order so that the mind of man can operate as a true mind, that the will of God can operate as a real will, whereby man as a causal agent is a true causal agent within the boundaries established by God. And that these boundaries assure that the choices of man can simply never foil or destroy the plan of God, that the end will happen as God has intended. Now, while I would say that some evil has no purpose, all evil has a reason. That is, there's a difference between a reason and a purpose. You say to me, why didn't you pay your light bill? I say, well, I didn't have any money. I have given you a reason. However, if you say, why didn't you pay your electric bill? And I say to you, because I'm protesting of the rate hike, now I'm giving you a purpose. So there is a difference between a reason and a purpose. So I affirm all things that happen have a reason, but not necessarily all things have a purpose. So it seems to me that by using the early chapters of Genesis to understand something of this creation order provides a robust understanding how the attributes of God work within human history. And furthermore, it seems to me to provide what I would call a sufficient framework for developing a Christian theodicy. Why couldn't there be a better world, if I'm right? Why couldn't there be a better world? And why couldn't that world be a world where there is no sin? There are at least probably two or three reasons that I can grant. One is, and let me, it will be rather simplistic, but one is because it is a contingent entity. Therefore, the only entity that could be forever perfect, of course, would be one that is necessary, and what we have is not necessary. So why don't we have a world that has no sin? And that is, I would say, if that would have been a feasible world, that's the world we would have gotten, because that would have been the best world. I would suggest, and I may come at odds with Lewis at this point, I would suggest that this is the best of all feasible worlds. It would be impossible to have a better world than what we have. If we're going to say then, if I say this is the best of all possible worlds, you say, well, what about, let's just say heaven, the eschaton. And we think in the eschaton, if we read our Bibles correctly, there is no sin there. There is no evil there. And that's a world. And that's where I would say, no, that's not a world. A world is everything from this world. The world is everything from Genesis to the eschaton. That is, heaven is not a different world. It is called a new, but it's not new in kind. It's only new in time. So I would suggest that when I say this is the best of all possible worlds, I look at the world that was created in Genesis chapter 1 and 2, or brought into being, actualized, and that eventually this world goes into a brokenness state because of sin, but will ultimately be brought back to what it was intended to be in Genesis 1 and 2. And it's just the eschaton is just simply another part of what we started in Genesis chapter 1. Why wouldn't there be a fall in the other world? Well, because it's not a different world. So the whole issue of sin has already been dealt with in this world, which is the only world. So if we were going to say it would be a different world, then I think that question has currency. But if we're saying, no, this is just a part of, there's just one world here, and sin has already been taken care of, and there's something that's bound up in the redemption that then assures that that doesn't happen again. And then I would say, it isn't that we wouldn't sin, but we will not sin in the eschaton. You're saying, well, there are promises, for example, in the book of Isaiah, where the lion will lie down with the lamb. That only happens now with the lambs inside the lion, but there's going to come a time when they'll lie down together independently. We read in the book of the Revelation that God will wipe away all tears. I'm affirming that will happen, but that is in the eschaton. So if we look at what we get in Genesis chapter 1 and 2, that seems to be the condition that we have at original creation. There's no there seems to be no animosity between the animal kingdom. Man is living in flourishing in a perfect state as a contingent entity can be. And here he is enjoying life. But sin does come in. So what Christ does in his redemption is not to lift us to a higher position than Adam had, but merely restore us to what Adam would have had, had he not sinned. So those promises will come to pass. And it's very interesting because those promises very much mimic what we have in the Genesis 1 and 2 account is, well, if there are possible worlds, is it possible that there was a world that didn't have quite as much evil in it as this world we have? Now, that can only, it seems to me, only be answered deductively. And that is, if we believe that whatever God does is always best because it flows out of who he is, then if that world would have been a world that was what I call a feasible world, one that could really have been actualized, then that's the one we would have had. And the only argument I can have for that is it is a deductive argument. And when I see in the Genesis 1:28, when God says, maybe it's 31, where God says that he sees everything that was made and it was very good, that seems to me to be a very strong statement of the best. You say, well, it doesn't say best. No, but when you consider who's making the evaluation, and the only thing at that time to measure it against is God himself. So if he says it's very good, I have to assume it could not have been better. That's one argument. The other argument is strictly on the character of God, that whatever God does, at least that's where I'm coming from, that whatever God does, that he always does the best. And so he's picked out of the possible worlds, the world that, and I don't know how this works out. There are people who have been forwarding, well, what kind of a scale does God use to pick out? I don't know. I've got some possibilities, but I dare not forward them because we may just prove to be totally wrong. So I think I'd just rest it with a very deductive argument. That is, if Adam and Eve were perfect, again, we qualify it, perfect as contingent beings can be perfect. That is, they're not perfect like God. Okay, but if we'll assume that they are morally without flaw, how is it then that they ended up turning against God if the will was perfect? Now, there are several ways of answering that question, but I will just offer one that comes from Augustine. And it seems to have some currency theologically for me. And that is that there were three goods, Augustine says. The one good are the universal goods, beauty, truth, etc. And then you have the lower goods. They're good, but they're the lower goods. And the middle good is the will. And it was God's intention that the will, which is good, could have turned up woods. That's where he wanted it. But it turns down. But it's the idea that, well, but everything is good, so that you can have a good will that turns. It just turns in the wrong direction. It doesn't. It's not choosing sin. That's what Augustine was saying, because it does seem from your question, and I've thought about this, if everything was just the way it ought to be, right, and man was perfect. But remember, another way to go with this, I've just given you Augustine's, but the other way to go with this is the fact is that man is limited, that he's a finite being, and finiteness cannot have moral perfection on its own. But limitedness is not an imperfection. Right? It seems to me that it is the limitedness that really gets to Adam, because what he wants to do is he wants to be like God. That's the promise that is given to him by the adversary. He doesn't want to have any limitations. So in his desire to be different than what he is, i.e. a creature, he then transgresses the command that God gives in order to reach out and to grasp this unlimitedness, which is not a sin in itself other than the fact that God said, don't do it. So Augustine may have a good go at this, I'm not sure, but it's something that we don't hear a lot about in evangelical theodicies, and probably Augustine is the one who has done the best on this. Okay, so where does evil come from in the first place? Well, my understanding would be Ezekiel 28. So evil comes, you have to look at what is the chronology here. I would take angels actually come into being before you have what we know as the creation of planet Earth. And because the Genesis starts out very interestingly, it doesn't doesn't start out with God creating the earth, you know, the globe. It says, and the earth was covered with water, which may indicate that it was present prior, okay? But so we read in Ezekiel 28, which I understand to be the fall of Lucifer, but he's in existence, I would say, before man. And so he makes the same mistake that Adam makes, but only in the angelic realm, according to Ezekiel 28. It's kind of mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fairest of them all? He said, he chuckles, it's me. And then we have in Isaiah 14, he says, seven times, I will exalt my throne above God. And then we read another text, how he's cast out of heaven. So evil in the angelic realm comes through the exercise of free will, making wrong choices, and now it sits outside, and now evil, in terms of how does it enter into the human race, well, Paul tells us, through one man's disobedience, it comes in. Now, did God create evil? No. Impossible. So all the church fathers have always said, evil has no essence. Evil is not a created thing. Evil is a parasite. Evil is the privation of the good. That is, in principle, evil is. Now, as evil acts out, in particulars, there is some actual activity, right? But evil, in principle, is a privation of the good. Now, that would have been Augustine's position. It was Aquinas' position. Matter of fact, Aquinas will even say that you can't have evil unless you have good. Because the fact is that evil is a parasite. Evil, it doesn't exist on its own. It only exists because there is good, and evil is the privation of the good.